One of my favorite moments of the year was to speak to an intellectual and a guy who's really leading the kind of freedom of expression movement in Canada. He is a guy called Professor Gad Saad, the professor of evolutionary behavior. We talked about everything from the craziness of political correctness to gift giving, risk taking, the effect of hormones on shopping for men and women. He spoke very passionately about free speech, the scientific method, not tolerating any bullshit. And he also talked about multiculturalism, gender, the regressive left, Canada's crazy prime minister, and many other things. Really an intellectual giant of our times and someone who took a whole bunch of his time to speak to us here on CliffCentral.com, Professor Gad Saad.
CliffCentral.com.
Gad Saad is a professor of evolutionary psychology and marketing, especially in the field of consumer behavior. He has a fascinating history, born a Lebanese Jew. His family fled Lebanon during the war there and took refuge in Canada, where he's been living ever since. A really scary story, Gad. I remember you telling it not so long ago about how you were hiding on the floorboards of the car. You had hired Palestinian militants to help take your family to the airport so that you could flee Lebanon. We're in 2017. I'd be curious about how you think anti-Semitism as a bad idea is doing in the modern 21st century world.
Right. Well, look, it was always growing up in Lebanon, even prior to the Civil War, you know, it was inculcated in you that you had to sort of be gentle in advertising your Jewish identity. I mean, so yes, you hear that people in Lebanon, you know, it was a pluralistic place, but people have to understand that it was pluralistic in the context of the Middle East, right? You know, it wasn't, you know, wear a Star of David the size of your head and walk around advertising your Judaism. It was rather, you know, we tolerate you until we decide that we're no longer going to tolerate you and kill you, right? I mean, so the history of the Jews is replete with such realities where you live peacefully and you coexist until some trigger arises, and then it's no longer viable to be Jewish in that particular area. And so I've always lived with the reality that I had this sort of dark secret that, of course, people could know easily if you were Jewish in Lebanon because, you know, they could just go and see who's at the synagogue. So it's not as though it was something that no one knew, but you certainly didn't advertise it. And then when we moved to Canada for many, many years, I no longer felt sort of that dark secret, something that I had, even though I would be exposed to anti-Semitism from people who didn't know that I was Jewish, who might say something to me in Arabic, not knowing that I'm Jewish. You know, there wasn't sort of this endemic anti-Semitism, certainly in my Western reality, but now over the past 10 years or so, I see the exact same instincts that I had in Lebanon starting to develop in me in Montreal. So, for example, I might go to a Lebanese store and I don't expect them to take me to the back and behead me, but I start worrying about things like, well, if they found out that I'm Jewish, they might spit in my food. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that was an instinct that I didn't have once we came to Canada, but now with the changing demography, I'm beginning to have it again.
Doesn't it strike you as extremely ironic that a place like Montreal, which is considered to be one of the most open-minded, multicultural, liberal in the old classical liberal sense of the word places in the world, that this is one of the places where you'd have to think about these things?
Yeah, I mean, it's breathtaking. Look, I mean, Quebec is in a unique sort of situation in that the Quebec government, and I've spoken about this in the past, but I'm happy to repeat it. The Quebec government is so concerned about maintaining its distinct French heritage. It is so threatened by this greater sort of tsunami of English Canada and certainly of the United States that it sets up all sorts of draconian mechanisms and policies to protect its French identity and its French language. So one of which is that they have had a very, very open immigration policy for folks who are coming from otherwise areas of the world where there's very little sharing of cultural, reference points, but they allow them in.
Because they're Francophone.
Exactly. And so I always joke that the Quebec government has decided that they don't mind if those folks eventually behead you, as long as they first say to you, bonjour, mon ami, in French. So as long as they behead you while speaking in French, then it's perfectly fine, because at least we've maintained our French heritage.
I'm not laughing because it's funny. You would know this better than any, because some people seem to have lost their sense of humor and attitude of political correctness. But, I'm laughing because this from a country which has Justin Trudeau as a prime minister. It's unbelievable to me.
Yeah, I mean, Justin Trudeau is an utter disaster on many, many fronts. I mean, first of all, and I say this again, not to be disrespectful, not to, be bombastic in any way, but I genuinely mean it that when I say the following. If I were to take in my 22, now almost 23-year professorial career, the absolute dumbest undergraduate student that I've ever had, that student would be approximately 100 times smarter than Justin Trudeau. And I say this, advisedly. Now, this is a guy who, until he was 40 something, was his biggest claim to fame was that he was a snowboarder and a substitute drama teacher.
Right.
And now he is the leader of, one of the most important Western countries in the world. He's never uttered a syllable, not a syllable, that wasn't a grotesque platitude of stupidity, right? Mm. I've even satirized, how do you generate a Justin Trudeau speech? Basically, you just sort of concatenate a random permutations of the word diversity, climate change, inclusion, and just play around with those words and you come up with random gibberish. He's a guy who's been infected with all of the politically correct platitudes of political correctness, of cultural relativism, of multiculturalism. And so it's as though Canada is trying to desperately repeat all of the errors that our European brothers have committed and trying to outdo them. It's really tragic.
And he really, apart from being the son of a former prime minister, doesn't have any credentials for this job either. He's a good looking guy, and that seems to get him a lot of votes too, which is the most ridiculous reason to vote for a politician. But it seems to me like the point where I realized I couldn't possibly have any common ground with Justin Trudeau was when post the death of Fidel Castro, he chose to say that this was a comrade and a friend of humanity, and that this was a sad loss for all of us that, Fidel Castro had hopped the perch, someone who we should have been cheering in the streets and jumping up and down and playing music at very high volume to celebrate the departure of.
Exactly right. And I don't know if you remember, there was a hashtag, I don't remember what it was exactly, but something like hashtag Trudeau eulogies, where everybody would come up with satirical and I had come up with some of my own that had, at least one of which had gone viral. I mean, every single issue that you could think of, he will be on the wrong side of that issue. I mean, I'll give you another quick example. When he was a parliamentarian, prior to becoming prime minister, at one point, some colleague of his had, in describing all of this stuff, the honor killings and the child brides and the genital mutilations and so on, he had described it as barbaric and that there is no such place for such practices, such barbaric practices in Canada. Mm-hmm. And Justin Trudeau's original response was that he was deeply offended and shocked and disturbed by the fact that this guy would use the word barbaric to describe the practices. So it wasn't that he was upset about the practices, but he was upset about the use of barbaric. Because, who are we to judge, the practices of those other wonderful brown people? And then, of course, there was some backlash, and then he came back and apologized and so on. But his first instinct was not to defend the integrity and the dignity of those little girls and those women, but rather to be upset that someone would categorize such mistreatment as barbaric.
Now, you're a scientist, and what you're talking about here is what ideologues do, is they take a word and they take a thought and they take an idea and it becomes canon to them, it becomes sacrosanct, and they don't allow even science, even the evidence of biological science, to get in the way of the way they see the world. For an evolutionary behavioral scientist, this must be maddening, because suddenly things like gender are social constructs. Someone can choose to be a furry animal if they do. In their heads, if they say it's true, then they are, right?
Right. I mean, it's problematic on so many levels. I mean, look, in my scientific career, I've had, you know, I sort of navigate in two separate realms. Amongst my natural scientist colleagues, you know, guys who are evolutionary biologists and evolutionary psychologists and so on, that of course the idea that we are biological beings, and hence, as you know, part of our biology is to recognize that we are a sexually dimorphic species, that there are innate sex differences. I mean, that's definitional. That's the starting point of describing our species, and nobody can, you know, nobody can test that. But then if I, you know, go to the other side of the campus and then navigate amongst my social science colleagues and humanities and so on, then simply arguing that there are biological imperatives. We're not born with empty minds and that are only filled with socialization. We are, all sex differences are not strictly due to social conditioning. That is a very, very contentious issue. You must be a Nazi for uttering such biologically vulgar statements. And so it's really been, I mean, both exciting and infuriating to actually have to convince people that, you know, humans in general and consumers in particular are driven by their biology. You would think that that is a profoundly obvious statement, but in the social sciences and the humanities, it's not, apparently.
And does your being from the Middle East, or being Jewish, or being incredibly good looking, does any of that help you in these? Does any of this help you in these arguments? Because these people are very easily swayed by groupthink. And by, they're persuaded by a victim hierarchy. And if you can tell them how you escaped Lebanon and you've been the victim of oppression and anti-Semitism, does this carry any weight with these people on the social science side?
I mean, not so much in my scientific work, because ultimately there, you know, you just, you know, you'd like to think that you have to convince them through your, with your scientific evidence. And so your individual markers, you'd like to think don't matter. On the other hand, when in my public engagement, where I take on political correctness and the social justice warriors, what you're talking about in terms of my personal history and my, you know, my characteristics definitely comes into play. Mm-hmm. And I then, of course, flip the script against them, whereby, you know, as you've probably seen me do, right? Whomever I'm facing, I'm likely to grossly score worse, you know, better than them, quote, better than them,
right,
in the oppression Olympics. And that really disarms them. And it demonstrates to you how laughable this whole exchange is, right? Rather than judging my arguments based on the merits of my points, the mere fact that I am Lebanese, who's escaped the Jewish war, who is overweight, blah, 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 that actually grants me cover. It makes it more difficult for the white journalist woman to accuse me of cyberbullying on Twitter, because I warn her, you better be careful, I'm a brown man from the Middle East, you don't want to be racist. And then she literally runs away in utter abject fear. And so I flip the lunacy against them, and luckily I always come out on top.
I want to get into some specifics of the stuff you've written about in your academic career. But before we get into that, your opinions are the things that I love to hear. And I'm going to give you a couple of things that we could just mess around with here, because really we could talk all day. And if I hadn't written a list of these things, we would talk all day.
I'm always happy to.
So let's talk about multiculturalism. I mean, particularly in a Canadian context, but also you watch what happens across the border in America, and you're familiar with what we've had to deal with in South Africa, a very unique history in the world, but obviously something which you and I have spoken about before. How do you approach multiculturalism, and do you consider it a good or a bad thing?
Right. So I think the starting point of that conversation has to be in agreeing how we use the word multiculturalism. Multiculturalism, as used colloquially, right, in everyday parlance, just means, you know, people of many cultures coming together. You know, it's pluralism. It's a synonym of pluralism. That's not what we mean when we're criticizing the political philosophy of multiculturalism.
No, that pluralism is not objectionable at all, I don't think, to any sane human being. Yeah.
Exactly. So we're talking about multiculturalism here as a political philosophy, which, by the way, Justin Trudeau's father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, is one of the architects of such a political philosophy. He made that law in Canada. And that idea really is, if you'd like, stems from, is a downstream effect of what's called cultural and moral relativism, right? The idea that, you know, who are we to impose our cultural hegemony on other people, right? I mean, we have one set of morals, one set of cultural practices. Someone else has their own. Who are we to judge theirs? By judging theirs, then we are being imperialistic, not necessarily militarily, but certainly in imposing our cultural values on them. And therefore, no, let's have a multicultural society where people come in, set up their own ghettos, live their own way, no pressures on them to assimilate within our cultural ethos. So that's what multiculturalism is. And to me, that's very, very dangerous. When I came to Canada, the number one thing I ascribe to, the number one thing that makes me proud of being Canadian and that supersedes any other identity, whether I'm Jewish or have green eyes, is the fact that the freedoms that are enshrined within Canadian society. That's what makes me Canadian. That's what makes me proud to be Canadian. And it supersedes any other identity marker that I might identify as part of my personhood. Now I do that just because that's my personhood,
right?
But multiculturalism says don't do that. You don't have to do that. If you think that female genital mutilation is okay, mm-hmm. then you don't have to abide by Canadian values. And that's grotesque.
Well, I suppose it forces people to then choose what is superior culture and what is ready to be left in the past. And you can call certain things barbaric because let's imagine, for example, you came from Borneo and it was okay to eat people there a couple of years ago, not even that long ago. If you come into a civilized country, and even using that word is considered very politically incorrect by some, it wouldn't be appropriate to, you know, dig a dead person up and eat a piece of them.
Right.
I mean, that's just that's just law, let alone cultural, cultural tolerance. And I suppose some people have just got to get to grips with the fact that some of the practices of some of the cultures of people around the world, and some of those are Western, let's be fair, are ready to be left in the infancy of our species.
Yeah. Look, I've actually released a while ago a sad truth clip on my YouTube channel where I specifically spoke about the rather obvious statement that not all cultures are equal. Again, people don't like to hear those statements because right away they somehow associate it with racism. You're right. Saying that those people over there right. are somehow inferior to you. No, I'm not saying. I'm saying that the cultural values to which they adhere are on specific points inferior to mine. Cultures that treat all people irrespective of their religious identity as equal are superior to those that don't.
Correct.
Cultures that treat men and women as equal are superior to those that don't. Cultures right. that don't throw gays off rooftops are superior to those that do. So it's not a profoundly controversial position, but I think the problem is that people have been so parasitized by some of this utter bullshit, this utter nonsense of political correctness, that they become disarmed. And that's why I call, I mean, the term that I've coined for it, people think that I just coined these terms to have fun, but actually I coined them because they really reflect a clear reality. Ostrich parasitic syndrome is exactly speaking to that, the parasitizing of a person's capacity to reason clearly. There's absolutely nothing contentious about saying that cultures where women are covered from head to toe, where they lose their identity in the public sphere, are inferior to those that honor women.
Right.
It's as simple as that.
Right. Now, Gad, how did it happen that those things that you've just mentioned, religion should all be treated, all the religions should be treated the same way, and people shouldn't be discriminated against because of their religion or the lack thereof, that people from different races should be treated the same because we're all human, you know, again, genetically, we've got such a tiny variance in our DNA that you can't even pick up, whether people are from different races. Sex, that men and women should be treated the same. These are positions that used to be firmly on the left of the political spectrum. These are things that were without a doubt and without any need to brook an argument, things that liberals proudly considered to be their values. How did it happen that saying those things that we've just agreed are those principles, that saying any of that has become considered to be right-wing or racist or in some way worthy of criticism? How?
Well, I mean, it's a combination of things. And actually, the answer to your question is really what I'm hoping to address in my forthcoming book, where the tentative title of the book is Death of the West by a Thousand Cuts. And basically, the idea is exactly how did we come to where we are now? And so, look, it starts off with a laudable goal that becomes hyperactive. It starts misfiring, if you'd like, right? So let's take a concrete example to explain my point. Mm-hmm. Feminism starts off with the idea that men and women should be treated equally, and you know, any liberal person, any clear thinking person should agree with that.
Right.
But then in the desperate desire to get rid of any possible sexism in society, you then create a narrative where you argue that men and women are biologically indistinguishable from one another, because if you don't argue for that, then it becomes easier to maintain the so-called patriarchal sexist status quo. And so you start off with the idea that, you know, you want to arrive at a laudable goal, and that's liberal, but then your desire to achieve that goal is so overpowering that you're willing to go through any lengths, right, to injure the truth so that you could maintain that goal, and hence you become an ideologue. So let me give you another very quick example.
Sure.
Why did many social scientists reject biology? Well, because a lot of, you know, miscreants, a lot of cretins had misused Darwinian theories, right? So there's a battle between the races, and we are the Aryans, we won. Hey, that's Darwinian. What's wrong if we kill others? Mm. British social class elitists said there's a battle between classes. We are the upper class. Who cares about the lower class? Let them die. Hey, that's Darwinian. Of course, Darwin said no such thing, but they're misusing Darwinian theory for their nefarious pursuits. And so social scientists came along and said, well, gee, biology seems inherently dangerous. It seems to lead to bad downstream effects. Let's create a new worldview where, you know, there are no human universals, where biology doesn't matter, where everything is culturally relative. And so what ends up happening is they parasitize their brains precisely because they originally have an honorable goal, and the pursuit of that goal is something that causes them to depart from reality. Do you follow?
I think you've very eloquently and in a very erudite fashion explained it better than I ever could. It comes from a good, in other words, it comes from a good place. It's just, it loses its way when it becomes ideological and refuses to take cognizance of the fact that there is evidence of certain things, but that the intention of science is never to be evil. And if unwelcome discoveries are made along the way, let's say, for example, that women prefer certain jobs to men. I had a conversation the other day with an academic. She's the vice chancellor of a university here in South Africa, and she took real umbrage at my pointing out that there are fewer, by degrees fewer, if you'll pardon that pun, engineering students who are women. And it's one of the most successful engineering campuses in South Africa. She was outraged that I should point out that there are fewer women entering engineering. And when I told her this, and she had to corroborate the fact by saying it's true, but she said we're doing our best to up the numbers of female engineers by artificially engineering it, if you'll pardon that pun as well.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, look, it's basically a rejection of reality because somehow it is thought that that rejection will ultimately lead to better ideological outcomes. Let me give you another example along the same lines of the example that you gave. Mm. So I did a Sad Truth clip a while ago where I reported on data from the U.S. Education Department looking at the educational attainment of across four degrees. So associate degree, which is like half a bachelor's degree,
right?
You know, 2 years of university, a bachelor's degree, master's degree, and then of course doctoral degree. So you had four educational attainment broken down across five races. you know, black, white, you know, Latino and so on, Hispanic. And so there were basically 20 cells, right? Four educational group, educational attainment groups by five races. And in each of those cells, I looked at the ratio of men to women in terms of, so for example, in the doctoral degree, for black race, how many men to how many women graduate with a doctoral degree? So I did that for all 20 cells. I'm going to ask you now to guess how many of the 20 cells did women outnumber men in terms of the obtained degrees?
I'm going to venture a guess, but before I do, who the hell would have given you permission to do a study where there might be unwelcome politically incorrect results like this? How was this ever allowed?
Well, it was the U.S. government that was coming up with the statistics. So all right. Apparently, go ahead, guess.
My guess would be 20 out of 20.
Very good, sir. 20 out of 20 cells, just for your listeners, for them to really digest this information. 20 out of 20 cells had more women getting degrees than men. In other words, if you made up the data, it couldn't be any more contrary to the narrative that there is endemic sexism against women on university campuses. Like, you couldn't make up data that is as compelling against the narrative. So I post this specifically with the intent to then, I mean, to share the information, but to then see what some of the comments will be. And as is typical for ideologues, the naturally lobotomized ideologues, you get some idiotic woman who says, no, 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 but, you know, in the pure mathematics department at some bullshit college, there are more full professor men than women. Aha, sexism exists. So even when you give people data that is at the aggregate level absolutely shatters the narrative, people will still hang on to their, you know, ideological position. And that's the problem that we face. People depart from reason. They don't care about facts. They care about defending their, you know, tribal mindsets.
I want to talk about those tribal mindsets, and I want to talk about the behavior, the attraction, the instincts, the biological stupidity of our species, how we manage to survive some of the time, how we prioritize survival, risk taking, all of that stuff, because this is really what you study, and then you take it in a direction of consumer behavior, which is fascinating
sure.
all on its own. But before we get to that quickly, there's a point you've made about Donald Trump, which I think will get a lot of people laughing and a lot of people very upset. You've described the reaction of people on the left to Donald Trump as being almost like a collective Munchausen syndrome.
Yes, sir. You want me to describe, you want me to break that theory for you?
Yeah, explain it to me like I'm an idiot, because I do remember thinking when I heard you describe it the first time how clever it was, and then I forgot what you actually meant.
Yeah, sure. So back in 2010, I had published a scientific paper in a medical journal where I was looking at some evolutionary explanations for an otherwise grotesque psychiatric disorder known as Munchausen syndrome by proxy. But so let me step back and explain what this disorder is. Munchausen syndrome is when a individual feigns medical illness because then he or she will garner the due sympathy and empathy for being, you know, injured or sick, right? And so Munchausen syndrome is that. Munchausen syndrome by proxy is when you have somebody under your care, a child, a pet, an elderly parent, and then you harm that child or that other individual under your care to then garner the empathy and sympathy. And hence it's by proxy, right? You're instantiating your narcissistic desire for empathy and sympathy by harming another. And so my original exposure to this psychiatric disorder was in my scientific pursuits. And now fast forward many years later, And here I am watching all the social justice warriors always crying victimhood, and then later seeing the incredible hysteria associated with Donald Trump, whereby everybody on my personal Facebook page would leave these just grotesque departures from reality where they're describing themselves as victims. So let me just give you sort of an example. You know, I am a woman of color who attends university XYZ, and now that Donald Trump has been inaugurated, I'm afraid to go on campus. I mean, how the hell is it that his ascending to the presidency affect the fact that you're going to take some bullshit bus to your bullshit university? I mean, he set up roadblocks for people of color so that they could be whisked away to gang rape centers. Right. I mean, right. But what it did is that it provided people with this immediate sense of victimhood, right? Everybody was a victim. I am a transgender person, and now I'm going to be gang raped by Donald Trump's death patrols, right? And so there was this, you know, grotesque, delusional, you know, orgiastic mechanism of everybody screaming victimhood. And so I thought, aha, this is a form, and hence I coined the term, of collective Munchausen. It's not just Munchausen at the individual level. At the collective level, these people are basically having these orgasms of full victimhood. So there you have it.
Why do you think they do that? Is it because victimhood has been arranged into a hierarchy and an Olympics, as you've said before, and that that's the best way to get social points? Or is there more to it? Is there a psychological, a deep-seated, even perhaps biological reason for some people to cling to victimhood? I mean, to me, and probably to you, and probably to many other people, victimhood is not a healthy state of mind.
Right. Well, I mean, from the Munchausen perspective, it's really somebody who is disordered in their thinking that they actually get a ego boost from getting that attention. Oh my God, poor you! You're such a victim, right? So in that sense, there is a psychiatric breakdown. But as you correctly said, in the less psychiatric version of why this is happening, it's exactly what you said, which is, I could now argue away your position, not by having to do the hard work of proving that my position is more veridical than yours. I simply have to show you my oppression Olympic poker hand, and if it outranks yours, then I win. And so from a cognitive laziness perspective, it becomes a wonderful tool to have. I don't have to worry about doing the hard work of accumulating evidence to argue your points away. I just tell you that I'm a brown guy who escaped execution in Lebanon. Ergo, I am right. Shut your mouth.
In other words, a Trump card.
In other words, a Trump card. Very good. Good. Well played, sir.
Well, you started. Well played, you brought the card analogy. It was only a skip and a jump from there. This to me is interesting stuff, because it indicates that there is a level of hysteria and non-reason of irrational thought that seems to somehow be taken more seriously than a good rational argument. Have we lost the ability in mainstream politics, in places like the United States, where freedom of speech is held to be a very virtuous and important and constitutional imperative? Have we lost the ability to sit down and battle ideas out until we discover which one is the best idea?
I hate to answer you in a pessimistic way, but yes, at the aggregate level, in a zeitgeist sense, yes, we have lost that ability. But I'll give you some, you know, I'll infuse you with some optimism at a much smaller scale than at the societal level. I just returned a few days ago from a trip at University of Nevada, Las Vegas, where I was invited to deliver a lecture. And on one of the evenings, you know, I had been invited by my hosts to dinner. And I sat down for a chat with some folks who typically would be, you know, very, quote, offended by some of my positions. So these were I call them faux liberal, right? Trump is the devil. Diversity hiring is wonderful. Identity politics is great. And so we sat there, you know, in my inimitable way where, you know, I'm very frontal, very respectful, but very frontal, right? I speak my mind. I started challenging these people, especially this one particular person. Now, here is what was beautiful about the situation. She had what I discussed yesterday on my show with Michael Shermer. She had epistemic humility. In other words, she was humble enough to say, look, I'm going to come to this discussion with an open mind. And if you end up in any way convincing me, I will be sufficiently humble to admit to that. And so the next day, after we had had this, you know, this difficult conversation, she came to me and again, with great humility said, you know what? A lot of what you said has caused me to change my opinion, on very, very cherished positions that I held. But now, why did this happen, right? I could have offered the exact same set of arguments, but if the person with whom I was having this tango with was not sufficiently epistemologically humble to be open to having their minds changed, their opinions revised, then I would have been speaking for no purpose, right? And so I think what we need to do, and I don't know, I wish I had the magic bullet, then, you know, the problem would be resolved, is to kind of try to engender that humility for all of our conversations, whether they be between you and I at a bar or whether it be, you know, across the aisle on Parliament. And so I don't know how we're going to foster that, but that's ultimately what we have to do if we're going to get out of this impasse.
The academic world, is there any greater or lesser degree of that sort of, you know, humility that you speak of?
That's a great question. And my answer pessimistically is actually, and maybe surprisingly to some of your listeners, they tend to actually be more dogged in their positions. I would have thought that, you know, I mean, a naive hypothesis might be, you know, the more educated you are, the more intellectual you are, the more intellectually sophisticated you are, the less likely you are to succumb to these tribal mindsets, the less likely you are to be, you know, arrogant in your epistemic approach. But the reality is that that's not true. And I think I have the answer as to why it's not true. I think it's not true because of all possible echo chambers, none is greater than the university. In other words, the university is a breeding ground for not having those tools. Why? Because all of the professors who ultimately shape the discourse in the university are all of the same mindset. And of course, this is not just me talking sort of anecdotally or, you know, instinctively. There are, you know, several studies that have demonstrated that, for example, if you look at the political affiliations of professors, it is utterly disastrous. Disastrous in what sense? That there is no diversity, right? And so as you've probably undoubtedly heard, you know, the faux liberals are perfectly happy to promote every possible diversity except the one that really matters, which is intellectual diversity. And so once we're able to break that echo chamber, then I think we'll have much better discussions.
I think we must attribute that quote to Dave Rubin. I think he may have been the first to use it online, but there are probably other smart people who've used it before. Either way, I just think that that's so counterintuitive that the places where thought, where ideas, where interrogation happens, that those places are now like prisons of the mind for so many people. It must be deeply frustrating, not only for the professors who do see that there is a lack of diversity of thought, but must be really annoying to some of your students. Do you have them expressing some of this to you?
Oh, yes. So I'm giving a invited lecture this coming weekend in Ottawa at a conference called the Manning Conference, where I'll be talking about, you know, freedom of speech on campus. And actually, almost all of my talk will be nothing but my reading emails that I have received from students. So to answer your question, from students, from faculty, and in a few cases from parents of students, specifically begging me for some advice as to how to navigate the stifling environment. And so, by the way, of course, I remove the identity of the people because I don't want to, quote, get them into trouble, which by itself is quite astonishing that I would have to do this. I mean, we don't live in North Korea, right? But, you know, you'll get a student who writes to me and says, Hey, Professor Saad, apparently it has come to someone's attention that I might not dislike Trump as much as I should. And now I found out that this neuroscience position that I was promised is going to go to somebody else, and my name has been removed from a paper that I participated on precisely because it came out that I'm a Trump supporter. What do you think that I should do? I mean, I received this email, and at first I think this can't be. This has to be a joke, right? There must be some hidden camera that is trying to check how I'm going to respond to this. It seems impossible to me that in the 21st century in Canada and the United States, a professor is receiving endless such personal testimonies from students. But that's the world we live in.
That's extraordinary. I'm kind of gobsmacked in a way by it, and above all because it's happening in places like Canada. What is your thought on Trump, by the way, since we're on him? Because, this is America. It's right across the border. I jokingly said the other day that if he really wants to make America great again, all he has to do is point all the nukes at Canada and get you guys to surrender, and he'll instantly turn. He'll make in one fell swoop. He'll turn it into the biggest geographical piece of single, sort of sovereign territory in the world. Second of all, he will add to the American population a lot of very well-educated, very sophisticated people. I'll give Canada the credit for that. And
Thank
then
you.
he can just resign the next day, and he will have made America great again. But they are your neighbor to the south, and in many ways, America does still lead the world. Now they've got this president who's got people like Meryl Streep hysterical, and lots of people
Right.
comparing him to the devil and to Hitler and everything else. But what do you think of him? And not based on what he's done so far, but on what he
Right.
said.
So my general feel is that, look, Donald Trump is, I mean, you couldn't have a worse orator if you constructed an android. He's not very presidential in his demeanor, in his eloquence or lack thereof. He says things that you wouldn't expect out of a jock in a locker room who's 14 years old. All those things are true. But on the other hand, as I explained in several venues and certain, perhaps most famously in my chat with Sam Harris, the very rational people could decide to vote for Trump for the following reasons. So there's a decision rule in psychology, decision making, known as the lexicographic rule, which basically says whenever you're making a choice between competing alternatives, you look at your most important attribute, and then you choose the alternative that scores best on that most important attribute. And so in the context of Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, if, for example, I'm someone who was uniquely concerned about, immigration and about the Islam threat, and if that's my overwhelmingly most important attribute on which I choose my candidates, then it's very conceivable for me to assume that Donald Trump scores better on that attribute than Hillary Clinton, and therefore I will choose him using that decision rule, even though on every possible other attribute, Hillary Clinton may or may not have been, scored better than Donald Trump. And so there are all sorts of psychological processes that one can use to fully explain how Donald Trump ascended to this presidency, as he did, right? And so from that perspective, I think Donald Trump provides us with several benefits. Number one, he is certainly grounded in reality when it comes to some of these existential threats that the West is facing, much more so than Hillary Clinton ever knew or at least admitted to it publicly. He is a catalyst of change to the extent that the current system was broken, was incestuous. Having someone who truly was from the outside, right? Somebody who could be an agent of change, or to use a cliche that I don't like, a disruptor. Well, Donald Trump does represent that. And so for several very valid reasons, it is quite conceivable that otherwise intelligent, sophisticated people could prefer Donald Trump. And so in that sense, I could fully understand why he ascended to the throne.
Well, I watch shows like Bill Maher, and I think Bill Maher is a smart guy, and I find myself laughing a lot with some of the jokes he makes, even about Trump. And I'm not a Trump supporter. I think that you're quite right to say that there are certain things that he just scores better than a very poor candidate like Hillary Clinton might have. But I do find that even Bill is prone, and he's a smart guy. He's prone to very broad, sweeping, and crazy. Like it's incensed him on some visceral level that someone like this should be in charge of the United States, and that all his supporters and everyone who voted for him must be a group of rubes and hicks and morons.
Right. Well, you know, on my personal Facebook page, of course, you know, a substantial portion of my friends are academics. And so I get to, if you like, see their comments that are, I mean, public in the context of my personal page. Mm. And I'm astonished at the comments that they make, right? So, for example, you know, a physicist colleague of mine wrote, I mean, I don't remember the exact words, but something like, well, if you voted for Trump, you are, you know, a hate-filled, evil, diabolical, illiterate, what, you know, whatever, a whole bunch of adjectives. Mm. And I thought, my goodness, I mean, imagine using those words for any other identifiable group. No person would do that, because that's exactly what bigotry is. That's what racism is. That's what a blanket statement is. And certainly someone within his Facebook circle voted for Trump, but he felt sufficiently emboldened in his position that he could post this publicly and feel that he doesn't need to in any way temper his words. And of course, I've seen countless other academics do this. Now, imagine if I happen to be a student who is under the power or purview of these particular folks. Am I going to, in a class, frankly speak openly about what I think of Trump? Let's say somebody wanted to ape the position that I just gave about why Trump might have ascended to the presidency. Mm. Would I have the right environment to say that? Of course I wouldn't, unless I'm somebody who has, you know, truly great testicular fortitude. Well, is that something that we want to be promoting as professors? It's grotesque. It's an injury to reason and to, you know, mature dialogue. And that's why I weigh against these things, because I despise seeing this from my otherwise respectable colleagues.
I'm writing down testicular fortitude as we speak. All right. Can we tap into the Dr. Gad Saad for a second here? Because
sure.
Evolutionary behavioral science. Let's talk about attraction and hormones and risk taking. There are a lot of categories sure. here, and I know that you could probably give us a really good lecture, but we would have to come to Montreal and pay for that. What I want is to understand the way that these things affect our decisions, especially when we buy things. People seem to spend money on sometimes ridiculous things. You've spent a lot of your time trying to figure out why they do that, whether it has a relation to hormones, whether there's a difference between the way men do it and women do it. What are these remarkable things that you've discovered in your time doing this?
Got you. So as a first statement, let me just kind of give you a sense of what evolutionary consumption is as a field. Basically, I argue that if you fully want to understand consumers, you have to recognize that while, of course, consumers are made, they're also born. In other words, we are an inextricable mix of our biology and our environment. And that holds true irrespective of which hat we're wearing, including that of consumers. And so what I try to do is uncover the fundamental biological and evolutionary forces that make us be the consumers that we are. And so let me give you some examples. So because you mentioned hormones. So I did a study with one of my former doctoral students where we looked at what happens to men's testosterone levels after they engage in conspicuous consumption. So if you put a man in a Porsche, what happens to his testosterone? Well, you're infusing him with immediate social status, and the endocrinological response is very obvious. His testosterone goes up. On the other hand, we looked at also what happens to men's testosterone levels if they watch another man engaging in conspicuous consumption. So that is on the male side. Uh-huh. But of course, women too engage in sexual signaling. And so with another one of my graduate students, I looked at the patterns of consumption choices, preferences, desires that women experience across their menstrual cycles. The idea being that, you know, different hormonal profiles take place depending on when a woman is in her menstrual cycle. And so, for example, we looked at beautification. What happens to how women dress as a function of where they are in their menstrual cycles? And not surprisingly, when they are in the maximally fertile phase, they dress more provocatively. So you can't take our biology out of us when we are consuming. And so what I basically do is I, you know, meticulously uncover these biological imperatives that define our consumption.
So when you talk about things like risk-taking, let's look at that quickly and the way that that our evolutionary behavior and our biology affects the amount of risk that we're willing to take on in our lives. You would think that humans would be, and if we take a long historical view of this, in the beginning we must have been very frightened primates. We must have taken very few risks. We would have tried to hide. Slowly we become emboldened as we develop tools. I would imagine that now we're at the apex of the food pyramid and we think we're probably in some way, you know, we're destined for becoming gods. We probably are our least fearful stage in the entire history of our species.
I mean, I might not use that particular narrative to explain the evolution of risk-taking. The one that I would use is more based on sexual selection. So sexual selection is the idea that, you know, a species evolves certain behaviors and certain morphological features because it confers reproductive advantage, right? So typically we talk about one of two mechanisms. Natural selection deals with survival advantage, whereas sexual selection deals with reproductive advantage. So the peacock's tail did not evolve to be so big and so iridescent colored and so on because of survival advantage. If anything, it reduces your survivability. Rather, it evolved because it serves as an honest signal of a peacock's genetic quality. That's what the hens want when they're choosing the optimal male. And so from that perspective, because we repeatedly see a universal difference between the sexes when it comes to risk-taking, men are much, much more likely to engage in a very broad range of risk-taking behaviors, more so than women. So the argument then is that this sex difference is a sexually selected trait. In other words, women, human females, have recurringly chosen men who are bold, who are aggressive, who take risks, and come out unscathed from having faced that risk. And so there's then a selection pressure for that particular penchant to evolve. And so this is exactly why, for example, in James Bond movies, you always see a scene where James Bond is playing, you know, at some casino, and he's always very cool, even though there's 10 million pounds at stake, and yet he always comes out unscathed and he wins. Well, what is that demonstrating? It is showing how I could face these risks, I could do it very calmly, and then I come out having won. And that's a very intoxicatingly attractive trait when women are judging men. So that's the evolutionary story for how risk-taking evolves.
What about gift-giving?
Right. So gift-giving is one of those really cool things that I like to study because it actually speaks to different biological drives. So gift-giving could be something that we give to family members, right? So I've done studies where I've looked at how do people allocate their gift-giving budgets as a function of genetic relatedness. And not surprisingly, people are incredibly attuned to this genetic relatedness. The closer I am to you genetically, on average, the larger the size of my gift. Now, people don't necessarily do this consciously, but they're ultimately Darwinian beings who recognize how to met out these investments. But I've also looked at gift giving as a courtship ritual, right? So when, you know, you go out on your first date, right? You want to take your partner in question to a fancy restaurant. You want to spend money on. I mean, one of the best ways to ensure that you never have a second date is to be frugal and cheap on your first date, right? And right? And that has nothing to do, by the way, with the feminist argument that, well, I don't need a man to pay for my meal, because you could have women who are billionaires who will still not go out on a second date with you unless you show cues of generosity and investment on your first date. So it's got nothing to do with the issue of power. It's got to do with the fact that it's part of the, if you like, what's called nuptial gift giving. Across many species, you typically have the males, but in some species, the role is reversed. But typically, you have the males who have to bring a gift to the female. And depending on whether this gift is appropriate or not, she will decide whether she's going to mate with you or not. Typically, the gift is some food you know, some food packet, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're an insect or a bird, the male will advance towards a prospective female, show her the food that he's willing to share with her. And if it's a good gift, she'll have sex with him. Well, guess what? Engagement rings are exactly that, right? And so, so there are all sorts of rituals that we do as consumers that might look different than those of our biological cousins, but they're simply the human manifestations of what happens across countless other species.
That has to be a fun thing to research. How do you go about something like that? Do you follow people around and watch their spending habits? Do you just gather big data? Do you
right.
observe them at close quarters? Do you question them post the fact?
Yeah, so all the things that you said are wonderful approaches, and I mean that's actually one of the nice things about what I do, at least in my own research program, is that I'm not methodologically fixated on one data collection approach. Hmm. In other words, what drives me is not a commitment to survey-based research or laboratory research or experimental research, rather I pursue interesting research problems, and then depending on the research question that I ask, then the appropriate data collection tool will manifest itself. So regarding the gift-giving studies that we were talking about, I've done gift-giving studies where it was survey-based, where you ask people, you know, tell me how you would allocate your gift-giving budget. So that's a survey-based. But I've also done studies where we've actually used actual gift-giving data. So I have an ongoing study right now with some Israeli colleagues where we have data from 30 Israeli weddings in terms of what wedding gifts the people who attended the gifts gave. So, for example, you know, Uncle Mordechai gave $200. Aunt Hannah gave $150. So in this case, we actually have field data, real data, yeah. not survey, right? So I use all possible tools as long as it helps me uncover the research question that I'm asking.
One last thing about this issue of objective beauty, and it's something that's always plagued me. You know, that we hear people, particularly feminists, saying, and a couple of postmodernists, and even some men who are, I suppose, trying to curry favor with women, they'll say there is no objective idea of beauty, and that it's magazine covers' fault that women feel pressured to be thin or to have, you know, a certain kind of hair or a certain kind of makeup or a certain sort of dress on. In all your studies, is there such a thing as a general application of beauty? And is it possible that we know at a glance what's pretty and what isn't, and that we're not socially constructed to think a certain way?
Absolutely. Nothing could be clearer than that. Now, before I answer that, yes, there are universal beauty standards, let me be charitable to those postmodernists and other idiots. There are elements of beauty that are culturally determined. So let me give you some examples. Yeah. In some Asian societies, there's what's called a neck elongation procedure where women wear these rings around their necks, and they wear an increasing number of rings as they get older to kind of elongate their necks. But then what ends up happening is that they lose the muscles in their neck, so that if they were to take off those rings, they literally wouldn't be able to hold their neck straight. But in that particular society, that practice is viewed as beautiful. Here's another example of a culture-specific beauty marker, something called lip plating or ear plating, where you actually, and this actually is in Africa, where you wear a lip on your, so that your lip, if you were to remove the plate, your lower lip becomes kind of this grotesque pendulous, at least grotesque by Western standards, but it's viewed as very attractive there. So while it is true that there are cultural instantiations of beauty, underneath these cultural specific beauty markers is a bedrock of human universals. Example, facial symmetry. There is no culture where facially asymmetric people are judged as more beautiful than facially symmetric people. Why? Because symmetry is associated with certain phenotypic cues of quality, of genetic quality. So how would you test this? Well, first of all, you could go around many cultures, show people images of individuals of varying facial symmetry and ask them which one they prefer. And everybody agrees, irrespective of the race of whomever is being judged and the race of the one who is judging, everybody agrees that facially symmetric people are more beautiful. But I could give you more convincing evidence. I could take children who are in the pre-socialization stage of their cognitive development, which mm-hmm. means that by definition, they don't yet have the cognitive apparatus to be socialized by Elle magazine and Oprah. Mm-hmm. And when I show them photos of people of varying beauty, where beauty in this case is again measured by facial symmetry, guess what? The infants will stare longer at the beautiful person, demonstrating that that penchant arises in the pre-socialization phase. So, you know, one of the beauties of evolutionary theory is that there are all sorts of methodologies that we could use to actually demonstrate the veracity of our arguments. So all of your postmodernists and bullshitters that are saying this nonsense, they're just idiots that are on the losing end of history.
Yeah, but we spend so much time arguing against their nonsensical positions that we aren't advancing science in the right ways. I mean, if we were still arguing about gravity, for example,
exactly,
wouldn't we have had to stop there before we could move on to Newtonian physics? It just seems to me that we've got caught up. And look, there are a lot of non-scientific people on the left and the right who are very, very dangerous to the ongoing march to human kind of improvement and civilization. I feel like we should accept certain things and just get on with it. If something is beautiful in other, I, for example, and you can give me an idea of whether this is fair or not, I have more fun being the ugliest person in the room than I do if I'm surrounded by people who are much uglier than me.
Well, I can't speak to your own personal preference, but let me speak to the more general point. You touched on something very important when you gave the example with physics. I mean, yeah. I've argued that what makes physics, chemistry, and biology, you know, seem more prestigious and influential and so on than, say, sociology and, you know,
gender
whatever,
studies. All
the gender studies and the other stuff, is not so much because inherently physicists are smarter than sociologists, or inherently because physicists do science but sociologists don't. And let me be very clear here. The scientific method is simply the application of a set of tools, a set of epistemological tools mm-hmm. to study the world. A sociologist can do it and a physicist can do it. So both of them could be equally scientists. The reason why they're not both viewed as equal scientists is because while the physicist adheres to the scientific method as best as he or she can, the sociologist allows the intrusion of ideology to permeate his or her work, right? So exactly as you said, while no chemistry, you know, chemist, you know, there aren't chemists who are for the periodic table, but chemists who are against the periodic table, right? But in the bullshit fields, you have yeah. people who can't even agree on whether there are innate biological differences between men and women. Well, if we can't agree on something so profoundly obvious as that, then how could we have a shared epistemology? We can't. And that's why you get the nonsense in sociology and women's studies. It's not because they're dumber. It's because they actually don't adhere to the scientific method.
And isn't it also true that science is that humility you spoke about earlier? It's the idea that your peers can come in and review your work at any time and are inquiring, and they're expected to hack it down if it's rubbish, to find the flaws in it. It is held up to scrutiny. And if they can find a reason to take down a theory that you've spent your life trying to build, then they must. It is their duty to take it to pieces, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, first of all, on a personal level, a scientist is full of doubt, right? I mean, they, again, because of this epistemic humility. But as you said, the peer review process for anyone who doesn't know what it is profoundly humbling, right? I mean, I sit and spend years working on an idea. Then I go out, develop the research instruments. I collect the data. I write the paper. So at the point that I send off the paper for review at some scientific journal, I've spent many, many years working on this. Then I get back the letter from the editor with the reviewer's comments. And oftentimes, you know, it's 10 pages of trashing you, right? But at first, you're upset, you're angry, you're frustrated, and so on. But then you take a step back and you say, well, you know, maybe statements 1, 4, and 7, I disagree with, but you know, the reviewer really has an excellent point regarding comments A, B, C. And I think that if I address those, you know, my research would ultimately benefit from it. And then you go through this beautiful dance back and forth until you get to a point where the editor says, you know, I think you've now passed the quality measure that suggests that we should publish this. And so that's, by the way, the beauty of science is that, you know, as you said, you're putting your ideas out there for people to specifically find faults in it. And if it survives that, then you could feel comfortable about it. By the way, that's why I hate religion and all ideologies, because somehow they feel that they don't have to go through that process, right? Simply by revelation, I am right because I am right because I am right. And that's an affront to human reason and human dignity.
I couldn't agree more, and you'll find no reason for me to sit and waste your time with an argument on that front. you know, there are so many other things that I think we could cover here, and particularly around your area of specialization. But I know you've got a hankering for California, you know, the warm weather and everything else.
Yes, sir.
Would you, if you were given a place in academia in SoCal, would you move there immediately in a heartbeat? You'd leave Canada behind?
Wow, nice question. Look, I mean, ultimately, the job itself would have to be such that it allows me to continue to flourish as a professor, right? So, for example, if I received a professorship in a California school that somehow was predominantly teaching, but it didn't allow me to set up a lab and do my research, well, then I'd have to, you know, question whether I'd want to do that. But all other things equal, at this point, as I get older, it's becoming increasingly more unbearable to, you know, withstand the torture of winter. And so to answer your question, you know, in one word, yes, I would move to California. So all Southern California schools, you are put on notice. The Gadfather is listening to all offers.
Well, Gadfather, thank you for an illuminating chat. It's great to pick your brain, and I appreciate you talking to us all the way here in South Africa. I hope you'll stay warm for the next couple of months, and then before you know it, you'll have a whole month of sun. How lucky.
Yeah, thank you. By the way, before I let you go, thank you for your kind words. In Montreal, we say we have four seasons: winter, 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 and July.
I wish you well, and keep on doing the good work, both in academia and with your upright stance on freedom of expression and fighting bullshit wherever you see it. Thank you.
Thank you, good sir. You're very kind. CliffCentral.com.